Lyle from Clovis, California.
Down a little more, yeah. That's awful. My name's Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Congratulations to all the chip takers, birthdays. That's pretty neat. I'd like to thank Lori and Matt for asking me to come out here. For me, it's a privilege to be able to do this, to show up and to try to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you, and hopefully maybe someone out there will get something out of it and it'll help you. I was taught early on never to refuse an AA request. If I was asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, not to refuse it, to do it. Here I am. Anyway, let's see. I grew up in a large family, four younger brothers, two older sisters. My dad was an alcoholic. Just a kind of a party animal kind of guy, and he liked to drink, and that's what he did, so as a kid growing up, like a lot of us here, I grew up in an alcoholic family. As a kid growing up, we moved around a lot. Started out in, I was born in Prosser, Washington. From there, we moved to, about 3-4 years old, moved to Portland, Oregon. From there to California. We've lived all over Northern California. About in the early 60s, stayed with my grandparents in Wichita, Kansas, Hutchinson, Kansas, and there back to California again. The reason I'm bringing all this up is because it kind of, what it did as a kid growing up, not being able to ever stay in one place and finish going to one school and having to, keep making friends over and over again, is it taught me how to be a loner and self-sufficient and not rely on anyone or trust anyone or depend on anyone. Just completely depend on myself. And and I took this view and this attitude on life into adulthood with me. The last place I lived before I moved to Los Angeles, and the San Fernando Valley is where I got sober, was here in Sunnyvale. This was the last place we lived. I called my mother earlier this morning to try to find out the address. She'll probably call me later, but anyway, I can't tell you where that was because I don't remember. I was about 12 years old at the time. But anyway, so our family, growing up as a kid, my dad was always trying to outrun the bill collectors. Somebody was always after him. So we moved a lot. Name a few of the places I lived here in Northern California: Newark, Sunnyvale, Vallejo, Manteca, and just to name a few. Moved to Los Angeles in about 1968, and we ended up in Inglewood, California, across the street from, in a kind of a hotel kind of apartment kind of place. Just one big room. It was my two older sisters had gone off by now and gotten married. It was still me and my four younger brothers, my mother, my father, and my mother's pet poodle. little toy poodle. Drove me crazy. I hated the dog. This is in Inglewood, California, and my dad found us this little place across the street from the forum, and that's where we lived for several months until he could get a better job, and then we moved to North Hollywood, California, which is still L.A., Los Angeles. North Hollywood is still considered L.A. City. We finally settled. I was in junior high school, Walter Reed Junior High School, and about the time we got settled there, my mother finally had had enough and divorced my father, and so now he's out of the picture. But prior to that happening, you know, as a kid, you know, we trying to go to school, and he'd come home at all hours of the day and the night, and just drunk, and 2 o'clock in the morning, and waking up the whole house, and then trying to get up and go to school the next morning. Anyway, this is just kind of how I was raised. This is she divorced him, and we stayed there in North Hollywood, and mother had to go on welfare to take care of me and my four younger brothers. She knew we were sneaking out. By this time, we're sneaking out, going to parties, and just kind of running the streets and doing whatever we felt. And I drank, even back then, I drank for the effect of alcohol. I drank so I wouldn't have to feel. I drank to escape. By now I'm about 13 years old, 12, 13 years old, and my first drunk, I drank to get drunk. What happened was my mother found out that we were sneaking out and going to parties, and she decided that she was going to nip it in the butt, and tell us. She told us, well, if you guys are going to do that, you tell me what you want to drink, and you can do it here at home. And I thought that was a great idea. heck, Mom, yeah, she even went out of her way, and one of the neighbors living in the building sold pot. So she decided, you smoke your pot and drink your beer here at home. She asked us, right away. I mean, she wanted to know what we wanted for beer. And for me, it was, malt liquor, Colt 45, Old English 800, the good stuff. That's the way it went. And my first drunk, I was drinking before then, but my first real drunk, that was my first real drunk at home. And I just remember it was great. It was awesome. I remember the feeling, the effect of it, and how it made me feel. It made me feel, I didn't feel less than anymore, and I felt like I was just on top of the world, and and I was it. And then also the physical effect, the mental, emotional effect. And I remember going out in the front yard with my brothers, and we're trying to walk. And we thought it was just funnier than heck, because we couldn't walk. We were falling all over the place, staggering all over the place, and we just thought it was great. Went back in later that evening, and I passed out on the couch and threw up all over myself. I was face up on the couch, and woke up to that. that didn't stop me. That didn't deter me from continuing the drinking. I wanted more. Today I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or I just became an alcoholic. Today it doesn't matter. I am an alcoholic, and I'm clean and sober alcoholic, and you know, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, so at about 15 years old, my mother picked up my four younger brothers and decided she was going to move. And by now, I've decided, you know, I'm tired of moving. I'm not going to move. She moved, and I stayed behind by myself, 15 years old, just running the streets in North Hollywood and staying with friends here and there, and picking up little odd jobs here and there. And I did have one family. It was a large family, and they all were painters, and the Burnell family. And they kind of took me in, and they taught me the trade. And you know, 15, 16 years old, I learned how to paint houses, and from real professionals, old time painters. You know, but then I still, you know, I stay in with the friends here and there, and time went on, and I had other odd jobs. I did some tree trimming. And then slowly got into construction, and that's what I do today. I'm a licensed general building contractor. You know, my drinking escalated, and the problems piled up, and My first wife had met, we'd met very young, met her when she was about 16 years old, and I was about 17 years old, and we were together about 6 years, finally got married, and we were together about 6 months after we were married, and she left me, and that pretty much devastated me. I couldn't understand why, you know, it completely took me by surprise. I kind of figured, you know, we're going to be together forever. That's what I had, that's the way I saw it. Her sister was engaged to one of my drinking buddies, Paul's his name, and Paul and I used to drink, party together, raise hell, and that kind of stuff, and we were good alcoholics, you know. We did what good alcoholics do, and blackouts, and racing around the streets of North Hollywood and Van Nuys, shooting out street lights at night, you know, that kind of stuff, and getting pulled over. I don't know how I ever managed, but I never got any DUIs. Back then we called them 502s. But I never got arrested for drunk driving. I got pulled over many times, never arrested. I was let off the hook three times where I should have been arrested. What happened was, Paul, the guy I used to drink with, he was a lot sicker than I was. He got into a lot of trouble with the police down there, and got arrested, and they took him in and had him for about 3 days interrogating him on a homicide that they thought he had committed, and finally released him, realizing that they had the wrong guy. But anyway, what that did to him is it put him in a tailspin with his drinking. And the reason I'm talking about him, the reason I'm talking about Paul is because he's my Eskimo. He's the one that 12-stepped me into the program. Paul got out of jail, and his drinking and drug use just really took off, and to the point where I actually asked him to leave my house, and here I am, you know, a big party animal, asking my drinking buddy to leave because he's too out of control for even me. Anyway, what happened was my sister-in-law broke off the engagement, and she left him, moved herself out of their apartment, and he came home one day and found nothing in the apartment and just a note in the middle of the living room that she couldn't take his drinking and drug abuse anymore, that he was an alcoholic, and just couldn't deal with him anymore. You know, this is what he relayed to me later on. But what that did is it put him in a place where he had to look at himself. And so Paul, you know, he asked her, you know, where do I find out about these AA meetings? She got him some information from an Al-Anon lady that's where she ended up, Al-Anon. And so Paul ended up getting a list of meetings and started going to meetings. And what he told me later was that when he came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, right away, he knew he was home, right off the bat. And Paul, his sobriety date is January 76, January 29th, 1976. He's still sober. Anyway, what had happened was Paul, I worked for Paul. He's a plumbing contractor, and I had been working for him. And when he'd pick me up for work in the morning, you know, we'd always have a six-pack of beer stashed away somewhere in the truck, and or, you know, whatever. A lot of times we'd have a couple beers before the first job, or sometimes we get, you know, we wouldn't drink till noon, but we'd always inevitably end up drinking and using somewhere during the day. Well, now Paul's sober and he's still picking me up for work, and he's a clean and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous now. And here's old drinking buddy Lyle still drinking and using. Anyway, one day he picked me up for work, and finally I asked him, I said, "Paul, what's with the different colored poker chips?" He had these different colored poker chips hanging on his shift lever on the steering column of his truck. And he had quite a few of them. Down in Los Angeles, when we take chips, we don't just take them at our home group or just one meeting. My sponsor and most of the old timers down there back then, they told you when you take a chip or celebrate birthday, you do it at every meeting you go to. You take the first chip or the first cake for you, and the rest are for the newcomers in the room. And that's kind of the way we do it. That's how we do it down there. Anyway, so that's why he ended up with so many chips. Anyway, I asked him, I said, "Paul, what's with the chips?" And he said, "Well, those are for different increments of sobriety. You know, I have some on there for 30 days, 90 days, 6 months, and 9 months." And he kind of handed them to me, and I was looking at them and like thinking to myself, you know, big wow, so what, you know? You know, that's too bad. I felt sorry for him because he couldn't drink anymore. You know, and so I handed it back to him, and I said, "Well, how come you don't drink anymore, Paul?" And he says, "Because I'm an alcoholic." And I remember this, you know, I was so oblivious to the disease and the effects of it that I had to ask him, Paul, what's an alcoholic? Because I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. And what he explained to me, he says, "Lyle, if you're an alcoholic like I am, it's a progressive disease that never gets better. It just continues to get worse. It's a twofold illness. Mental obsession of the mind with physical allergy of the body coupled with mental obsession of the mind. And once you pick up that first drink, it creates a phenomenon of craving, and you can't stop drinking." He kind of elaborated a little bit more on it and said, gave me some examples. You know, he said, "Lyle, if you're an alcoholic, you know, at times your life might seem like it's better. You'll have a better job, drive a nicer car, living in a better apartment or house, and things will be going along smooth. But it'll always be followed by a still worse relapse. And what'll happen is, your drinking will progress, and you'll either lose a job, get a 502, or nowadays it's a DUI, or you'll lose the apartment. Something will happen with your car, you'll crash it, and I crashed quite a few of them. And it'll continue to just keep getting worse. It doesn't ever get better. Just at times it might seem like it's getting better, but it's always going to progressively get worse. And what he told me that day, that morning, just stuck with me. For some reason, whatever reason, it just stayed with me. I remembered it. Shortly after that, I remember working on a job for him, and I was out in the front of an apartment building digging. We're putting in a water service, and he came up to me and said, "Lyle, you know, you can't work for me anymore. I can't work with you anymore, so this is going to be your last day." And I remember kind of my feelings were kind of hurt. And I was thinking, well, that's all right. You don't drink anyway. So that's what I was thinking. That's what I thought, you know. And, you know, today I know now, today, you know, after I got sober, I realized that he just couldn't stand to see me destroying my life anymore. And it was affecting his sobriety, being around me. So he was doing it for his own good and mine. Anyway, so what happened was a year or so went by, and had forgotten about the whole thing, and had some other friends, you know, that I could drink and use with, and my drinking progressed. And one day, it was a Monday, and the weekend before, I had blown my whole paycheck, couldn't pay my rent. Had somebody after me. I had bought an answering machine from some guy, he was after me. He was wanted to kill me because I didn't pay him for the answering machine, and I owed him. I owed him $20 for it. You know, it's a $20 answering machine. I mean, that's just kind of where I ended up. And what happened was I had come home early that Monday from work, and went in, laid down, took a nap, and I dreamt that I had committed suicide in my dream. That I was just so sick and tired of being sick and tired, so depressed, and so just that feeling of hopelessness, and nothing's going to change. It's just that. You know, I was suicidal. And so I woke up and thought to, and the first thing I thought of, well, you know, Paul's right. You know, it's gotten worse. So I called him and I threw in the towel. And he took me to my first meeting. And, you know, and I stuck around for about 90 days. And I loved Alcoholics Anonymous then, and I was real, you know, I just, like most newcomers, I was just real on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. It, you know, I had the same feeling. I felt, you know, I'm home. What happened was, because I still hadn't had a sponsor, and I was kind of doing half measures on the steps. I had gone out on an all-day fishing boat with some friends, and I had one of my friends had walked up to me and offered me a beer, just handed it to me, and without even giving it a second thought, I just took the beer and drank it. The book talks about being struck drunk, you know, if we don't have a solid foundation, and that's what happened to me. I stayed out drinking for only about 2 weeks, and then I came back again. I came back because I knew that I was going to end up in even worse condition if I didn't. Anyway, I came back. This time, I stuck around for a couple of years. I put together about 3 years in the program. And this time what happened was I would come to meetings. I had a sponsor. He would make suggestions, and I just wasn't taking the suggestions. I was still doing it Lyle's way. And what happened was, you know, the first step, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I knew my life was unmanageable. I didn't have a problem with that. But, you know, outwardly, if you came up and asked me, how are you doing on your steps? You take the first step. And I'd say, yeah, I got it down, no problem. But I wasn't being honest. You know, because I couldn't get the first half of the first step, I was in denial and still thought I had power over alcohol. I still had that thought in my head that I could still control my drinking. So time went by, and I continued to work the rest of the steps and would meet with my sponsor, and I came to meetings on a regular basis. But what slowly, gradually happened, because I wasn't really working a program, and I wasn't being totally honest, I slowly worked my way to the back of the room. And the reason I was sitting in the back of the room is because what happened was, when I'd sit in meetings, people would share. I'd sit there and I'd take their inventories, and I'd judge them. And what that did is it created a wall between me and the fellowship, and it made me more and more comfortable, more and more uncomfortable with myself because of what I was doing. And I started slacking off on meetings, started communicating less and less with other members in the fellowship, and spending less and less time with my sponsor. And eventually what happened was it got to where I wasn't going to any meetings anymore, and then started hanging out with the old crowd again. What happened was, one day, also by now too, I was engaged to get married, and we had a son together, working on my second wife, Kim, and we had a son together. He was born October 13th, 1980. And here I am, I'm guessing I was around about two years sober. And so I was sober when he was born, but what happened was, because I was still doing it Lyle's way and I wasn't really doing the deal, I ended up hanging around with the old crowd. We ended up, and I ended up cheating on her. And, you know, I was in denial about that too, because what happened was I was going with these friends, and we were going out bar hopping and to clubs, and I still wasn't drinking. I was drinking Cokes and stuff like that, and hadn't started drinking yet, but I was hanging out with these guys. And eventually what happened was I didn't come home one night, and next day I came home and all my stuff was in the front yard. She had taken everything I owned and just threw it right into the front yard. So what happened, by the time my son's first year birthday rolled around, I was already drinking and using again. And what happened was I went up trying to do the same thing or something. Anyway, I was sitting at the bar. This bartender walked up to me, and I'm drinking a grapefruit juice. He asked me if you want me to add something to that for you. And I said, no, I'm not drinking. And by the time he walked down to the other end of the bar and was waiting on some other customers, I thought to myself, Lyle, you're not an alcoholic. He goes, you're just, you know, Lyle, you're just a victim of the environment you grew up in. You just have psychological and emotional and mental problems, you know. You're not an alcoholic. Once again, you know, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I still wasn't powerless over alcohol. So what happened was, by the time that guy waited on the people at the other end of the bar, which was only a couple of minutes, and walked back down to the other end of the bar, I decided in 2 minutes' time, 2-3 minutes' time, that I wasn't an alcoholic anymore. And he asked me again. He said, "You sure you don't want me to add something to that?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." So he turned my grapefruit juice into a Greyhound, added some vodka to it, and I was off and running again for about 3 years. And you know, all I could really tell you is that it got worse, you know. For me, mentally, emotionally, and psychologically, you know, I was just bankrupt, just gone at the end there. And no matter, you know, talk about maldiscontent, you know. I would try to do things, you know, to make myself happy. I would make plans to do things. I tried taking up surfing, you know, and in San Fernando Valley, you're not too far away from Topanga State Beach, Will Rogers State Beach, Malibu, you know, any of those beaches I could get to in about 35, 40 minutes, you know, if the traffic was right. And what I'd do is, you know, I would decide I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to the beach today, you know. I'm going to meet some people, and I'm going to enjoy life and have fun and go for a walk on the beach and walk out on the pier and talk to strangers and make new friends. And I was trying to make myself happy, you know, and I'd load up the ice chest with beer, and I'd take off and head for the beach. And as I'd approach the turnoff for the parking lot into Topanga Beach, I'd look, and there'd be people out there, you know, living life and families having fun, and be a beautiful day. And I'd look, I go, "Ah, it's too crowded," and I'd just keep driving. I get to Malibu, and it'd be the same thing. "Ah, it's too many darn people out there, darn." I just keep going. By now, I'd had, you know, 3 beers in me, and Topanga and Malibu is only about 25 minutes apart. Then I get out to County Line. Be the same thing. County Line, Los Angeles and Ventura, where they meet out there. There's a big rock out there. They call it Bass Rock. One side is LA County, the other side's Ventura County. And I keep going. I get to Point Magoo, and you know, I'm in Oxnard now, and my beer's almost gone, and I turn around, I just make a big giant circle, I get back on the 101 and just head right back to where I came from, you know. By the time the day was over with, spent 4 hours, you know, making all these great plans and going to do all these wonderful things for the day, and did nothing. So at the end of my drinking, What finally happened, the straw that broke the camel's back for me was, so to speak, was I was living in my friend's guest house. He had rented me his guest house behind his house, and I'd been living there now for about 6, 7, 8 months, I guess, and he was on me because I was always late on the rent, and I would just kind of go to work when I felt like it. I was doing construction then, working for a contractor, and he kind of tolerated me, probably an enabler, I guess, kind of kept me going. But anyway, it was 4th of July, 1984, and we were having a big barbecue, family and friends. My son was there, from Kim, who we ended up breaking that off and never did get married. Anyway, he's about 3.5 years old now, and there's a bunch of kids, another family, and this friend of mine, and I decided, you know, it's 4th of July, and I'd been drinking all day, and wanted to kind of liven things up, And so I decided, well, my insane alcoholic thinking decided, you know, well, I'm going to liven things up. Darn it, we don't have any fireworks or nothing, so what can I do to liven this up? You know, it's 4th of July, Independence Day. So I went into my little guest house and got out my Ruger 10/22 rifle and took the magazine out of it. It had a 10-round magazine in it, and I emptied the magazine. And because I'm in construction, we have these... Luke's laughing at me. He knows where I'm going with this. You did that too, huh? We have these, they're called shots, or 22 caliber shots, and they're rated differently, you know. And what they're used for is you put them into what's called a ram set, and you take a case-hardened nail, and you put the case-hardened nail in the ram set, and then you put the cartridge in behind that, and you can fire these nails into concrete. Well, all these basically are blanks. So I loaded these 22 caliber blanks into my magazine, stuck them back in my rifle, and went running out of my little guest house into the backyard. These kids are running around swinging and sliding on the slide and playing in the swimming pool, and barbecue's going, and people are just having a nice relaxing 4th of July, and I come running out of my little guest house firing this rifle in the air. Blam, 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 shells ejecting all over. Everybody just scattered. Just kids all ducked under the slide, and my own son, you know. Even, you know, he ducked under the slide with the other kids, and Kelly, this good friend of mine I've known since I was about 15 years old also, he's another drinking buddy, just not as insane as me, kind of a functioning drunk, I guess, comes up to me and says, "Lyle, what the hell's wrong with you? Are you crazy? Are you insane? You just scared the hell out of everybody. Somebody's going to call the police. You're going to go to jail." I go, "What are you doing?" You know, he reprimanded me for my actions and for what I did. And what that did is it made me realize once again the disease has progressed. And, you know, what I think is okay and sane behavior wasn't. It was 10 days after that I threw in the towel again for the third time. This is my third try at Alcoholics Anonymous. So my sobriety date is July 14th, 1984. Last July, I celebrated 21 years of sobriety. Now, you know, I'd like to be able to stand up here and tell you all that, you know, it's all been good, it's all been great. I've been a good AA and done the deal and worked a good program. but I'm stubborn, you know, I got a thick alcoholic skull, you know. I was about 6 years sober this last time in the program. I slacked way off on my meetings. I stopped working a program again. There were a few things I was still doing, and probably the only things that really saved me was, you know, the guys I was working with in my trade were all clean and sober members in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would kind of get me to go to meetings, you know, with them once in a while. What happened was, a lot of good stuff has happened to me in my sobriety. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, it takes what it takes, I guess. Whatever, you know, each of us are different as individuals, but as alcoholics, you know, we're all the same as far as our disease goes. I met my wife, Joanne, who's here with me today, and we met in July 87. I waited for Joanne to get 1 year in the program before I went and asked her out, because the sponsor told me, you don't hit on newcomer women, and if you're going to date them, you wait until they have a year of sobriety. And okay. I'm still going to meetings at this point. Kind of had my eye on Joanne and thought, you know, she'd make a nice girlfriend. And I'd listened to her meetings and stuff and got to know her a little bit. But anyway, she celebrated 19 years, our daughter's birthday is July 23rd. Anyway, we'd met. What happened was we used to go to this meeting called the Old Timers Meeting in Reseda, a clubhouse called the Owl Nest, and it was called the Old Timers Meeting. And you couldn't participate in that meeting unless you had at least 10 years of sobriety. By now I've got my Harley Davidson and I'm really impressing everybody and being the biker. And I went to this meeting and Joanne was there. So I asked her, and they were having a dance at another clubhouse in Newhall, a clubhouse called the Rafters. And so I walked up to her at the meeting and I asked her if she'd like to go out, you know, go to a dance with me at the Rafters. And she said, yes, that's how we met. And we stayed together, kind of. We kind of bounced back and forth for, I think, the first year. But eventually we did get married. We got married in September 9th, 1989. We've been married ever since. Our daughter just turned 14 years old, July 23rd. She's born in 91. The neat thing is, you know, that little girl has never seen her mom and dad drunk. My son, by the time I had come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, he was about 3.5 years old. He didn't remember. The only episode he remembered was that 4th of July. Other than that, he didn't really recall anything. He hasn't really recalled anything, any of my drunken episodes. What happened was, you know, like I was saying earlier, I kind of got off on a little bit of a tangent. I'd like to say that I did it all right, but I didn't. And about 6 years into my sobriety, you know, I had to experience some real uncomfortableness. And some self-willed ran riot, you know. And I got arrested in sobriety. And what happened was... you know, I had so much bottled anger and rage in me, stuff that I had never dealt with, I was on my way home from getting lunch for me and Joanne here, and I was on my way home and with lunch, and where I crossed the intersection to go home, it bottlenecks into one lane, and there was this lady that came zooming from out of nowhere, you know, and... she had cut me off and almost caused me to go into oncoming traffic and hit another car head on. And what, you know, because I had this rage, I zoomed after her and I practically run her off the road, got in front of her, jumped out of my truck, and went running up to her car, screaming at her, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And she came at me with her car. I think she's probably one of us. Serious. Yeah, she was flipping me the bird and cussing me out. She came right at me with her car and backed me all the way up onto the tailgate of my pickup truck. She turned away and started to drive off. And when she did, I kicked her car. And she turned and looked over her shoulder and was cussing me. And then turned around and started to drive off. And she realized that I had left the door open on the driver's side of my truck. Anyway, she got that kicking her car cost me a door. But the point I'm trying to make is that you know, this happened in sobriety, and it happened because of nobody else's doing, because of my own, because you know, I still hadn't figured it out that you know, there's 12 steps to the program. If we work those 12 steps and we're honest with ourselves, and we have a sponsor and we use that sponsor on a regular basis, which makes me accountable, which makes us accountable to someone. And I believe that all alcoholics, we all need to be accountable to somebody. You know, had I been working a program and doing those things, I would have been a little more thorough in my fourth step, and some of this stuff would have come out. And done the amends the way I was supposed to, this stuff would have come out. Anyway, about 90, this is before therapy or after therapy? 96, I had been in and out of seeing therapists throughout my sobriety. But in late 98, I started going back to meetings, and I was seeing a therapist, and, you know, this woman was a godsend because she was an Al-Anon, and her husband was an alcoholic and clean and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She helped me get back on track. The whole time all this stuff's going on, my wife Joanne was going to meetings, and, you know, she was doing the deal. It's what, in Clovis, we have a fellowship called the Sierra Fellowship, and Saturday mornings we have a stag meeting there, and we call doing the deal is working the steps, having a sponsor, being accountable, being honest with yourself and other members, the whole nine yards. So anyway, Joanne was doing the deal. I was kind of half measuring it, and one day, you know, in 2001, We sold our house in Northridge and moved to Clovis. And I look at this now, and I really believe in my heart of hearts that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I was so set in my ways, and living in the San Fernando Valley where I got sober, that I guess I just... wasn't getting it, you know. Like I said, I was in construction, and most of my clients weren't in the San Fernando Valley anymore. They were over the hill. They were Santa Monica, West Hollywood, Brentwood, or Redondo Beach, Palos Verdes, and that's quite a ways out. I was spending a lot of time on the 405 freeway, and getting real burned out on that. Anyway, what happened was we sold our house, and we were looking for a place to live. We couldn't find anything in Thousand Oaks or the San Fernando Valley or Simi Valley. Joanne's sister lives in Fresno. We come up many times to visit her, and on vacations to Yosemite and Sequoia. So we were already familiar with Fresno. We came up looking, and we found a place in Clovis. Ended up moving to Clovis, and again in my sobriety, I hit an emotional bottom. And what happened was I realized all I could think of was that is back to basics. You know, I got to get back to basics, and I was in a real tight spot emotionally, and. I was feeling sick and tired again, and real uncomfortable in my own skin, and I knew I needed to do something, and I was very depressed and suicidal. And this is, you know, I'm new to the community in Clovis, and there's one gentleman sitting here in the front, Manuel. I've known Manuel since he got sober, and I remember I used to come up and I'd shake his hand, and he'd give me a hug, and, you know, and I never knew if this guy was going to haul off and hit me or not. But he's come a long ways, you know, really have. I guess where I'm going with this is, you know, you can have a lot of years of sobriety. You can have a lot of years. But you know, if you don't do a fearless and thorough moral inventory, and you don't ask God to remove your defects of character and mean it, and don't make the amends, and you don't use the sponsors the way you're supposed to, the way it's meant to be, that's what can happen. You know, it's hard for me to stand up here and tell you that, but it doesn't matter how many years you have in the program. If you're not working a program, it's a progressive disease. I believe that it progresses even when we're not drinking. And, you know, so for me, you know, I believe that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I've always believed that, for me, if I get up in the morning and I do my meditation, I do my prayers, and I ask God for His will for me, not mine, then whatever happens in that day is His will, whether it be good or bad. You know, I might think it's something bad that's happened, but the end results, you know, God's in control. So for me, for me anyway, it isn't a mistake that I ended up in Clovis. That's the way I look at it today. Anyway, today I live the kind of life that I used to always dream about. You know, I've done all these, all the things I used to dream and think about and fantasize about when I was out there drinking and using. I've done an Alcoholics Anonymous clean and sober. You know, I my first 3 years of sobriety, while I was going to meetings and you know, I took up surfing and I did that. And then when I got tired of that, I got into riding motorcycles. And from there, I went on to I got into rock climbing to death for about 10 years. But, you know, and I have my own business today. I live in a nice home in a good neighborhood, and I drive nice cars today. And for the most part, most of the time, I'm comfortable in my own skin, and probably that's the biggest gift of all. You know, and I have a family today. And I mean to say, Alcoholics Anonymous is my family. And, it's an extended part of my family. No matter where I go, you know, I'm at home when I walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Matt asked me at an H&I business meeting. We were at a meeting together, and he asked me if I wanted to come up here and speak. And I was kind of a little reluctant because I don't consider myself a speaker. But I was told early on, you know, not to turn down an AA request. Am I running over? I am? Oh. Anyway, you know what? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have friends in AA today that I used to just always dream about, you know, having as friends. Matt asked me to come up here. Matt was one of the first friends I had in Clovis when I moved there. And I was telling you about Manuel here. I watched Manuel come in, and he's a completely different person than he was when I met him. And, you know, for me to be able to participate and to see that happen in someone, to watch him grow, that's a gift in itself. And also Luke here just celebrated a year of sobriety. And I got to be part of that. We got to celebrate our birthdays together. Just so you know, I have 19 years, 364 days more than he does. If he would have waited one more day, it would have been an even 20, but oh well. You know what, I don't know. We have a 14-year-old daughter together, like I said, and she's never seen her mom and dad drunk. She knows we're alcoholics. We're clean and sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and have a 25 in October, Brandon, and I think sometimes that he may be one of us, but he's in God's hands. I've gone over, so I'm going to stop. Thank you for allowing me to do this. Thank you.